Episode is brought to you by hand sanitizer.
Okay, great.
You really need that shit.
Yes. Dang, I hope Tom Brady doesn't see this.
Trust me, you probably won't.
Immediately regret this decision. Ron.
I know. Let's have a spelling contest.
Don't piss down my back and tell me it's raining. Gotta cut you down.
All right, guys, welcome to the new segment of the This Is Tampa podcast. I'm calling it Let's Have a Beer because, you know, I like beer. And the way this is going to work, yeah, she's got vodka or something. I don't know what that is.
I've got high quality H2O because I'm currently working. So I'm going to stick
ABV,
with the
zero.
Yes.
So, yeah, anyway, the interview lasts as long as it takes me to drink this beer. So if it's good, it's gonna take me a long time to drink the beer.
Okay, you know? Great. Well,
if
hopefully it takes a while.
If you see me going quick, then you gotta do some tricks or something.
Then I'm nervous, then I'm worried.
Yeah.
Okay.
Anyway, we're here at 81 Bay Brewing off of Gandy Boulevard, right?
Yeah.
South Tampa.
Yeah. Small business market.
Yeah, small business market happening.
And a meet and greet with myself.
Meet and greet with Monica. Scott.
Monique Look Scott for Hillsborough County Court Judge.
Yep, Scott for Judge.
Yeah, I love the hat. The hat's amazing. I gotta get one of those. Yeah, so we're here doing, you know, we're here supporting the small business market, especially now during these trying, difficult times. It's challenging for any small business. And we've also got elections coming up. A month from today, August 18th.
Don't forget, get out and vote.
Get out there and vote.
Vote Scott.
Yes, and remember to vote Monique Scott. But yeah, we're here because we wanted to provide an opportunity to voters to meet me, share with me their concerns, ask me their questions, and then for me to, you know, have a chance to tell them why they should vote for me and why I'm the best candidate worthy of their vote and support.
Yep. All right, great.
Yeah.
And before we go any further, you know, we're going to talk about your background and everything, but this episode is brought to you by hand sanitizer.
Okay, great.
You really need that shit.
Yes.
Right?
Hand sanitizer, yep. You need it like every 15 minutes.
So, you know, we're practicing semi-social distancing here and doing the best we can. We had our mask down out there. If you saw our Facebook Live, you probably didn't understand a word we said because we were under the mask, but we did the best we could. Anyway, going into this, I asked you a couple questions before our meeting here.
Correct.
And one of the things I found really interesting is that you are from Tampa?
Right.
Born and raised?
Not born. I was born actually in Boynton Beach, Florida. Okay. But my parents moved here shortly after I was born into Tampa, Florida. And I was raised in town and country, Hillsborough County, Tampa, Florida. Right. Yeah. So
yeah, you're at least a Florida girl. You're a Tampanian.
I'm a Tampanian.
Yeah,
yes.
For sure.
Yes. Absolutely raised here. You know, graduated from Sickles High School. Before that, I was at Jefferson High School. And before that, I was at, Roland Park, Blake, Webb Middle School. I went to three different middle schools, even though I was in the same house. Jeez. So yeah, it's
you're trying them all out.
And I've lived almost every part of Hillsborough County. I've lived in town and country. I lived in New Tampa. I've lived in Brandon, Lithia, Valrico area. I work in South Tampa. So
where'd you live in New Tampa? I ask because that's where I live.
Oh, okay. So I was going to school at USF, and before USF became a little bit more of school where students would actually live on campus. I don't know if they didn't really have many dorms when I was going to USF.
Right.
So we lived in, I lived in a couple of different apartments in New Tampa, Tampa Palms.
Tampa Palms area?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, so, you know, it was more of a commuter school at that point. And so some of my roommates and I, we had a couple of apartments in Tampa Palms, and we would just drive, you know, from Tampa Palms to USF.
Man.
Yeah.
So you're talking years ago.
Yeah, I'm a little bit older.
No, you look good. You look young. You look. You'd never guess. Listen, yeah. Trust me. She's well qualified to be running for judge.
Well, thank you.
Looking at this background, I mean, you were a police officer?
Right. So I was a police officer with the Tampa Police Department. That was a really great experience. So I graduated from USF. And immediately after graduating, I actually took an internship with the Washington, D.C. Public Defender's Office. So I actually moved to D.C. and I bought a one-way ticket there thinking I was leaving town. I was like, I'm done.
Seemed like a good idea.
Right, it did. But I got there in the middle of the winter in D.C. With no car. And it's freezing, and taking the metro and walking in snow was not
It wasn't
for me.
Your thing?
It wasn't for me.
You're like, what is this white crap on the ground? Why is it so cold?
Yes, it's,
Hey, so, I was born and raised in New York, so I know, you know, snow.
Yeah, and the whole city, you know, the whole city, D.C. area shuts down when it snows a little bit, so... but yeah, I ultimately, you know, came back to Tampa, and as soon as I got back, I was fortunate enough to get recruited by the Tampa Police Department. They have a scholarship program, well, I won't say a scholarship program, but a program where you are recruited, they pay for your academy, they give you a stipend, and once you complete the academy, you are sworn in as a Tampa Police Department officer, and you are with that agency. Typically, most people who are interested in law enforcement, they have to pay their own way through the academy and then apply to an agency. But I was fortunate enough where TPD took an interest in me and recruited me. And, you know, I went through the academy, got sworn in. Unfortunately, that career was cut short pretty abruptly because I am also disabled. I'm not disabled, but I have a disability. I'm epileptic. So I was diagnosed with, by the time I was 10, I was diagnosed with epilepsy. And it's a condition that is, there's no cure. It's a lifelong condition. And, you know, I was fortunate enough to have the kind that's controlled through medication. And I was fortunate enough to lead a very normal life. I never really was affected by epilepsy until I was unable to continue working for the police department at that time because they would not allow me to receive the pension because I was epileptic.
But you never had like a...
Right, no. It was all controlled through medication. The last time I had had a seizure before then was when I was in high school. And there was little educational component here about epilepsy. One in three people are affected by epilepsy. One in three people will have a seizure at some point. There are over 20 different kinds of seizures. Most people know of grand mal seizures, which are the kind where people will sometimes fall to the ground and start convulsing. I don't have those kinds of seizures. If I were to have one, it's called an abstinence seizure, and it's basically where you just kind of like zone out for a second, you daydream. But again, I was fortunate enough to have a milder case, if you want to describe it that way, and be controlled through medication. So growing up, I never really told people about
it.
It
took a long time to even notice it, right?
Right. For your parents, probably. Right, exactly. So here's the interesting thing. We don't know how long I was having those seizures in school or at home because no one really noticed. I actually was fortunate enough to have a teacher who had a very keen eye and was able to pick up on it and told my parents, this is why her grades are kind of struggling because she's having these and she's missing parts of the instruction. So we're gonna talk about it a little bit later, but I eventually did become a teacher, and in part, I credit my career in education to this, my fourth grade teacher actually, her name was Miss Perotti, and I attribute, my interest in education and my passion for helping young people because of her, because had it not been her, you know, keen eye, I may have gone undiagnosed for a while. So the career with the Tampa Police Department did get cut short unexpectedly because of my epilepsy. It's unfortunate because that was in 2006, and in 2009, three years later, the American Disabilities Act was actually reformed to include epilepsy as a condition which would be covered under the American Disability Act. So it would have never have happened. I would have been qualified for the pension had it had happened in 2009. So
you were already moving on.
I was already moved on at that point. You know, I'm you're going to find, and people who take the time to listen to my story, you'll learn that I'm a very resilient person. I have had my fair share of adversity, and I'm a strong believer that, you know, when we go through adversity, it makes us stronger. It creates character, humility, integrity, and because I've had those experiences, those obstacles, it's made me a better person. So I moved on and I became a teacher. I taught for 5 years. I taught fourth grade, fifth grade, third grade.
What was more dangerous, the police officer or the teaching?
Well, I think the harder job was definitely teaching.
Yeah.
You know, because you've got administrators, you've got parents, you've got students, and it, you know, can get difficult at times trying to, you know, make sure that everyone's on the same page and the lines of communication are open. And
yeah, well, and just, you know, keeping their attention, right? Like the fourth, fifth grade, you said?
Right. Fourth, fifth grade. I taught sixth grade science, sixth grade. Eighth grade science. Did not believe in puberty until eighth grade.
Yeah.
Because those eighth grade boys, man, they were, they were hard. They were like, whew, they were very emotional.
Yeah. I don't think I learned anything in those grades.
I think middle school is a tough time, right? Because the kids are kind of going from adolescence, you know,
well, that's
to
why
like
they keep
little
them separate,
kids, big kids.
Huh? That's why they keep them separate.
Yeah.
Know, sixth, seventh, eighth.
Right. It's like a transition in life.
It's like a halfway house.
It's a transition for sure. It's definitely a huge transition. So, yeah.
And so you were in the thick of things there.
Yeah.
That's pretty good.
So from there, the experience in teaching gave me an opportunity to kind of see some of the disconnect between the education system and the criminal justice system. So, for example, I had a student who, this was when I was teaching eighth grade science, I had a student who stole a bunch of laptops. The problem is that when you steal something that's over $300 worth of value, then it becomes a felony. So you're talking about a kid being charged with a felony crime. And where I...
Tried as an adult?
No, as a juvenile, but it's still, like when you're tried... When you're charged as a juvenile, yes, that juvenile record stays like as juvenile record, but if they're ever charged as an adult later, there's a 5-year kind of like recapture period. So like, let's say they commit a felony when they're 15, but then when they're 21, they commit another felony, then that can go on their score sheet. And so it can actually be considered.
It can compound.
Yeah, kind of.
Right.
So so when the person's 21, that will still be looked at. So they basically, it's kind of one of those situations where, yes, it's off of your record,
right,
and it should be sealed and expunged as a juvenile. But ultimately, if they ever commit another felony 5 years after, then it will be on their score sheet, which is what's used to determine.
It have to be related to the, it can be totally different crime, like one could be theft and one could be beating somebody up or whatever,
battery. So in this case, what I was concerned about as an educator was that I never saw the kid again. He got expelled, and he was a good kid. He had some problems at home that I knew about, and I knew that because I was his teacher. You know, I spent however countless amount of hours and time with this kid, and I was never contacted, asked, you know, if there was something that we could do as teachers, and I felt that that was a missed opportunity. So I got interested in the law and started to go to law school part-time while I was teaching full-time. I went to law school at Stetson, which Stetson's a really great local law school. We're actually number one in trial advocacy across nationwide. So I did graduate with a concentration in trial advocacy. So once I graduated from Stetson's law school program, I actually took a job with the state attorney's office here in Hillsborough County.
So you were prosecuting.
Right. So a state attorney is a prosecutor. So we are representing the citizens of the state of Florida, specifically Hillsborough County. So when a crime is alleged to have been committed, then the prosecutor is the person who represents the state of Florida or the citizens of Hillsborough County and has to prove that a crime occurred beyond a reasonable doubt.
Right. So have you ever done, I mean, it doesn't say defense attorney. So you're going from, you still prosecute or you still?
No. So I've actually, I left the state attorney's office and now I'm in private practice doing defense work. Okay. So criminal defense, family law, and personal injury. Yes.
Cool.
Yeah, so I've been on both sides. I mean, like I said, I did start off with the public defender's office as an intern investigator. You know, like I said, I've been in the classrooms as a teacher, the streets as a police officer. I have been a prosecutor doing prosecution work, but I am on the defense side right now doing defense work.
You got a lot of experience.
Yeah, a lot of experience.
Especially something, you know, for being a judge.
Right. It's very well-rounded, and I think it's very relevant experience.
Yeah, it is.
You know, like, and I'll give you another example. I was in court one morning. I was on duty. It was over the weekend. Because court proceedings do go on over the weekend. We don't shut down. I was in court. One of the judges had a younger person come before him. I think he was accused of a theft as well. And this judge, it was amazing. This judge, he had the principal's phone number on speed dial in his phone. And
really?
Like right then and there called the principal and said, what do we need to do for this kid? Like, what can I do to help you? And that's the kind of judge that I'm going to be.
So that's what's inspiring you.
Right. I mean, it's judges like that that I see taking the extra step.
Yeah, it was a phone call.
Right. It was a phone call. It's super
it
easy.
It could have major implications in somebody's life.
Communicating, like, right? Opening those lines of communication between our educators and working more on a holistic approach on how we can help this young person. So that way they're not going to go down this path and, you know, not address what the real issue is. Because most of the time, they made a bad choice, but we know that they're not bad people or anything like that. It's something going on at home. It's puberty. It's, you know, it's just being a young person in this day and age. It's difficult. It's not easy. So it's maybe their friends that they're hanging out with. It's a number of things. And if we as judges are more involved and in touch with the community that we're serving, and we take those extra steps by reaching out to our administrators, principals, educators, or teachers, and work together, then I think we are doing a better service to the community.
So, like, on that, how do you, I'm sure you had to do it as a prosecutor too, but how do you separate any, like, preconceived notions you might have about somebody or a case or something like that? Like, and where do you draw the line of, is it something like the cause and effect? So, mm-hmm. if this is caused by something at home or whatever, you know, you see a kid, it seems like he's good. And I don't know if you've seen the show, Jacob's, what the hell is it called? Defending Jacob?
No, haven't seen it.
Got Captain America in it.
But I haven't seen that. I feel like maybe I've heard of it. Yeah.
I think it's on Netflix.
Okay.
It's pretty interesting because you still don't know it. I watched the whole season. I don't know if the kid's guilty or not.
Oh, okay.
But he's a good kid and he gets accused of a crime, murdering somebody.
Okay.
And obviously the father is, you know, on his team. You know, he refuses to believe that his kid could be, could be implicated on this. But
so the way that I handled it as a prosecutor is I had already had two careers by the time I was a prosecutor. Okay, I had the career, the experience as a law enforcement officer and as a teacher. So I had already had a little bit of life experience to understand that things are not black and white. There are many different levels and shades of gray. So as a prosecutor, when I had a case come across my desk, you know, you get a police report, you read through the report, you obviously talk to the officer, but you talk to the witnesses as well, and you talk to the victims. And then the defense attorney, you invite them into your office and you sit down and you have a conversation with the attorney, and the defense attorney, you know, presents whatever the defense is. And you listen. You listen with an open mind and understand that there are circumstances beyond, sometimes beyond the accused's control, like socioeconomic, right, circumstances in his life, like just, you know, possibly a good person or a good youth, a good kid that made a bad choice or a bad decision. It's like a one-time thing with no criminal record. And you take all of those things into consideration, and you do your best to seek justice. And when you're seeking justice, it's not just prison or probation or jail. Seeking justice is like, well, let's remedy the actual issue here. So sometimes, a lot of times, it's treatment, okay? So it's drug treatment, it's mental health treatment, domestic violence treatment. I was in domestic violence court for 9 months, where all I prosecuted were domestic violence cases.
Jeez.
And a lot of times, the person who is accused of domestic violence, guess what? They grew up in a domestically violent household. So the cycle is just like never ending. And if we're just throwing them in jail the first time that they commit such an offense,
it's not going to solve anything.
Right. We need to get them treatment. We need to get them seen by, go to therapy and recognize the signs and teach them coping mechanisms. So I'm a big, you know, proponent of that as a prosecutor. If I could find a way to get a person into that and they qualified and the victim approved it, because that's another important consideration, is what does the victim want? You know, 2 years ago, our Florida Constitution was amended to include Marcy's Law. It's an actual constitutional right now in Florida that victims have the constitutional right to have a say in what happens to the accused, as to like what happens in their case, like what court of sentence that they want. So if a victim tells me, let's say it's a husband and wife and they have a child in common, if the victim tells me, and let's just say it's the standard male and female kind of thing, right, where the male is the abuser and the female is the victim, and the wife tells me, listen, you know, he's been under a lot of stress, he lost his job, he does have a drinking problem, you know, I want him to get help, that's what I want. Then I listen, as a prosecutor, I would listen to that victim and we'd offer him the treatment. And if he was willing to take it, then by God, do it. That's great. So, you know, you just really have to keep an open mind, listen to everybody. And, you know, where discretion is used as far as a prosecutor, you try to find justice. And justice, again, is doing the right thing by everybody.
So as a prosecutor, like when a situation like that comes up and say you think that the better thing would be for that person to go into this rehabilitation or whatever it is program, you make that recommendation to the judge, and then it's ultimately up to the judge to take that, or how's that work?
So it can happen in two ways. So most cases are negotiated pre-trial. So that just basically means that the state gives an offer to the defense and the defense accepts the offer before a trial. So like, let's say in that scenario that we just talked about, that the wife tells me, you know, I want him to go to treatment, and I look at the case and I, you know, consider everything and I think, okay, I think that that's a fair offer, so I'm going to make that offer to the defense attorney. And I say, you know, he qualifies for the domestic violence intervention program. Let's get him into treatment. Defense attorney talks to his client. Client accepts. We go in front of the judge and we say, Judge, we've come to a negotiated agreement. The defendant's going to plead to domestic violence intervention program and go into that program. The other way is where the client, the defendant, the accused, turns down the offer and demands his constitutional right to a trial. If he demands his right to a trial, then it goes before six members of his of his peers, a jury, and we present the case to a jury. It's the state's burden to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. If we're successful in proving the case beyond a reasonable doubt and the jury comes back with a guilty verdict, then it is up to the judge to determine the sentence.
Okay, so in the first scenario, the judge couldn't just veto it and say, bullshit, this is, you know.
No, the judge actually can. If the judge, in the first instance, looked at it and saw
this happened before, and the wife keeps letting him off the hook.
In that situation, the judge could say, you know, I'm looking at his criminal record here, and he's had 5 instances with the same victim, and state, I understand that you're willing to make this offer, but I'm not willing to accept it. So yes, the judge can say, I'm unwilling to accept the offer. And the judge can say, he can plead open to the court. So the accused would plead to the judge, and the judge would actually render the sentence.
Right.
Or the accused could say, I want a trial. And then you go to trial. And the trial route, the judge is going to determine the sentence. The state can give a recommendation, but it's just a recommendation. The judge doesn't have to follow it.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's where it switches. Like if you when you are made appointed judge or voted in, mm-hmm. I should say, that's where you're switching. It's kind of why you've learned all along the process of being a prosecutor and now on the defense. Mm-hmm. Both sides of it. I find it interesting because, as a defense lawyer, you have a fiduciary duty, right, to your client. Is that correct?
Right. So there is a duty to your client to advocate for your client.
Let me stop you. Are you compelled if you find that your client is lying, and that he is in fact guilty of the crime, mm-hmm. where does that affect the fiduciary duty to defend them if you know in fact that they are guilty? How does that work?
So for example, as a defense attorney, your responsibility is to kind of have the best outcome for your client. However, in doing so, you cannot commit a crime in doing that. So if you put your client on the stand and you know that that client, the accused, is about to commit perjury by lying on the stand under oath, you basically cannot ask him any questions that would enable him to lie, so him or her. So if I have a client who tells me, you know what, I'm going to take the stand and I'm going to lie, and I'm going to say XYZ. And I'm going to strongly encourage him not to do that. And I am going to, before he takes the stand, I'm going to ask to approach the bench, and I have to actually inform the judge that I believe my client's about to perjure himself. And then if my client still wants to proceed, I actually can't, as an attorney, ask him any questions because that is an effect enabling him to lie. Now, my client can provide any testimony he wants.
Right.
That's his right. But I can't be the enabler.
You can't commit. Yeah.
Yeah.
You can't commit.
Yeah.
Hey, Tim, come here for a second. We got, because this is important. He had a question for you earlier that he wanted to ask about red light cameras. So let's do it now. Let's put you on
and
the spot.
And we were just
right
on the topic of perjury.
Right, yeah. So
so I have a question. Let's say I run a red light camera.
Or the vehicle that I own, someone runs a red light camera, and the person in it, I know they take pictures, is wearing a mask.
So
who's going to be held accountable for that?
Well, if you're my client and you come and tell me that, I'm going to tell you that, you may have a case of, we can try to present a case of misidentification, but if it ultimately comes to a situation where you have to provide testimony, I'm not going to allow you to perjure yourself. If you tell me it was you that in fact was driving, then it would be worse. It would be better just to pay the fine than to commit a perjury.
I see.
You know, so I would tell you to cut your losses, pay the fine, and let's move on with life. Don't worry about a red light.
So you're working right now, before you get elected as judge, you're actually a defense attorney now.
Right.
So has there been times in your profession that you've really told someone, hey, look, I'm not going to represent you. I know you're guilty. I can't help you.
No. It doesn't work that way. If a person, you know, comes to me and, you know, says that, they usually come and they tell you a story. They mm-hmm. don't say I'm guilty or innocent. They tell you this, they say, here's what happened. Mm-hmm. And they tell you their story. And so my job as a defense attorney is to represent them with the best defense possible so that they have the best outcome possible. So if that outcome is that I can somehow get the case dropped, fantastic. Because maybe law enforcement, you know, didn't conduct a proper search. Or maybe there is, a Miranda violation. Miranda wasn't read and there was a statement that was read that implicates my client. Well, that statement gets thrown out. Maybe it's a situation where there is an actual story and my client, you know, may be guilty, but he would benefit from drug treatment or mental health treatment as opposed to going to jail or to prison. So I try to work out the best thing for him so that way if the issue is drug abuse, then let's get you some drug treatment. Let's get the state to come on board, agree to this, and let's go that route. You know, I mean, nine times out of ten, the client takes accountability and they recognize that there's a consequence that has to be accounted for. So, you know.
It's about the storm. All right, did that answer your question?
That did. That answered my question. That was actually round two. Last time I had a chance to interview with Monique, I asked her, what if I run a red light in a red light camera and tell the judge it wasn't me driving? And she hit me with that pretty hard. She said, you know, number one, perjury. Number two, you have cameras. So I quickly thought, well, now I'm wearing masks when I run red lights.
You wear a mask in your car?
So, well, maybe when I go through a red light, who knows? But I've rode this straight and narrow ever since we've had that talk. I've obeyed all traffic lights and signs since we've had that. So if you haven't done anything else, you've made the street safer just from one conversation with me. So thank you for that.
Absolutely. All right.
Yeah. Hey.
All right. Well, Siri jumped in there.
Sorry.
It's Siri interrupted. Anyway. Yeah. So,
yeah, I mean, overall, just a really unique perspective from being, you know, from all three careers. Additionally, I'm super involved in the Tampa Bay community. I serve on four different boards, the Epilepsy Service Foundation, the Tampa Hispanic Bar Association, the Hillsborough Association of Women Lawyers, and the Sheriff's Hispanic Advisory Council. Each one of those organizations provides mentorships to young individuals, male and female. Each one of them provides scholarships. Each one of those organizations has some sort of, fundraiser to benefit the demographic, the population in which they are seeking to help. So, you know, really great work with them. I'm very proud of the work that I've done with those organizations and each of my careers. Overall, I just think it's important that as a candidate running for judge, that I have my involvement in the community, so I have a sense of what's going on and I have a sense of the makeup of the community. But I'm also, you know, a candidate that, again, brings a really unique perspective by being in the classrooms, being in the courtrooms, and being in the streets, and then being on both sides of the defense and prosecution.
Right. That's pretty legit.
Yeah.
You got the experience, you got the, you know, it sounds like you got the right reasons for wanting to be a judge, you know, making a difference in the way that a judge can. But let's, you know, tell me a little more about you, your family.
Okay. Yeah. So let's see. first generation American. My parents moved here from Colombia, South America. They moved in the early 80s to get away from all the violence and civil unrest that was going on in the country at the time. My mother comes from a family of 10 children, lots of kids, yeah. And I don't know too much about my biological father because he was just really not a good person. My mother was fortunate enough to get out of that relationship shortly after arriving here in the States. Unfortunately for me, I did have to continue seeing my biological father once a month, but he was just not a good person. He was emotionally, verbally, mentally, and sometimes physically abusive. So I did grow up as a child in a domestically violent household. So that was another reason why I became a police officer and a prosecutor, was because I've always had a strong passion for protecting especially domestic violent victims.
Right.
Growing up in that situation as a child, I'm sympathetic to it, and it did make me stronger. And I was lucky to get through it, but not everyone's so lucky. I remember one instance where we reported a case of abuse to the Department of Children and Family Services, and had somebody come out and interview me when I was like, I don't know, I must have been like 8, and nothing happened. So I was definitely that kid that fell through the cracks, which sucked. But my mom was really strong and really smart, and she was a very good role model for me. So I grew up here in Tampa, graduated from Sickles High School, went to college at USF on scholarship. I was able to get the Florida Bright Future Scholarship, which I was really fortunate for that, because I don't know if I would have been able to go to college had it not been for that. So probably not. So yeah, that was really great. Always working. I started working at the age of 15, and I started in community service at that age too.
So going back to like personal life, like you're married, right?
I am married. I'm married.
You have 8 kids?
I do. I have a 15-year-old son. So yeah, he's in high school and he's driving. He's got his driver's permit 2 weeks ago, so he's really excited about that. And he's your typical 15-year-old. I mean, he's going into his sophomore year in high school.
He does this a lot.
He's got the phone, and he's he's an athlete. He's a soccer player.
That must be the Colombian in him.
Yeah, he's been playing soccer since he was 3, yeah. And he's just really great, and he loves it, so. Yeah.
Only child?
Only child.
Yeah. So, how did you meet your husband?
So, I actually met my husband at USF.
Yeah. I thought it was going to be a cool story, like you arrested him or something.
No.
Or pulled him over, at least.
That would be weird. No. We met at USF. It's kind of a very vanilla story, I suppose. Yeah.
Met in college.
Met at college.
Had a kid.
Got married. I mean, he's a good guy. He's from Tampa as well.
Wow.
He grew up in Temple Terrace.
Tampa.
So, yeah, I know. What are the odds?
Keeping in the city limits.
Yeah, he, very fortunate to have a very supporting husband.
That's important, especially doing what you're doing.
Yeah, it's a lot of work, and he's always been really great about just, having my back, which is what everybody needs in life. You need at least one person to have your back.
Pretty much every success story has that person behind the scenes.
Exactly.
Helping out.
Yeah.
That's good. That's great. So I'm going through this. Don't look at my notes. This is the notes that you sent me. Now, you have a couple interesting. You said travel on your future plans.
Yeah.
Probably, after you get done doing what you're doing. Where do you like to travel to?
We love traveling internationally. So neither myself or my husband traveled internationally until we were adults. My husband grew up in a similar kind of situation like I did, so we didn't have a lot of opportunity, I guess you would say, but that also gave us a sense of appreciation for the things that we now have worked so hard for.
Right.
So one of the reasons we love traveling is that I think traveling provides culture and provides the ability to have to be more open-minded and experience different cultures and experience. Well,
what's some of your favorite places, or what's some of the places you're really looking forward to?
I would love to go. I think next that's on the list is, I have yet to meet, go to the United Kingdom or France. I would love to go to those two places. Ireland. Yes.
Hey.
Yeah.
I'm half Irish.
Yeah. I would love to go there. It looks beautiful. Let's see. Where else? Africa, I think, would be amazing. Australia. I mean, I'll tell you the places I have been to. I've been to Spain. I've been to Colombia, South America, of course. I've been to Greece and Italy. So I've got the rest of the world to visit.
Those are some pretty good ones, anyway.
Those are some pretty good places, yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, you just got to go see Big Ben and the Louvre and all that other stuff.
Go
do the whole European, like...
huge museum person.
Yeah.
Like, my husband gets super annoyed with me because I could spend all day in a museum. He's one of those people that likes to just kind of, like, walk on by. And I'm one of those people that has to read everything in the display.
Just bring snacks. He'll be fine.
Right? Yeah. I mean...
bring snacks. Give him snacks. He'll be all right. So, anyway, one of the cool things I want to do with this, well, I don't know if it's cool yet. Hopefully it is, but...
We'll see.
I'll
let you know.
It's not
that cool.
Yeah, you don't know about this. I always like to do something fun at the end of the podcast with my guests. So I'm calling this segment, Would You Rather?
Okay.
All right.
Would I rather? Do I get to ask you
the same
questions too?
No, I get to ask me nothing.
Aww. That's no fun. Okay. All right.
I get that. You're my guest.
Okay.
They don't care what the hell I'm going to do.
All right.
Maybe
you would want to know.
Some of the interesting facts, and the reason these are they say that is because you put down in your hobbies that you enjoy fantasy football.
I won my fantasy football league.
That's why you enjoy it. If you came in last every year, you wouldn't enjoy it.
I'm super proud of it. I'm like the only girl in my league too. So
based on that, would you rather take Tom Brady with the first overall pick or take Gronk in the fifth round?
Like now?
This year?
Oh.
They're both Tampa Bay Bucks now.
Right, yeah, I know. First round's kind of a big pick.
First overall. So you got
first
number
overall.
One pick.
Yeah. I
don't
know. Dang, I hope Tom Brady doesn't see this.
Trust me, he probably won't.
Well, you never know.
Tom, if you're watching, hey, reach out.
Love you, Tom.
I know you need a house. So.
Okay. See, Gronk gets injured, though, too, because I've had Gronk on my team a few times. Usually waits till later in the season to play him. Man, is this the hardest question you're going to ask me?
I don't know. Yeah, I guess.
Okay. If I were in the drafting room for Tampa Bay Buccaneers, I'd have to take Gronk.
No, that's for your fantasy team.
Oh, for my fantasy team.
Yeah.
Oh, well, then Gronk. Yeah, you don't take a quarterback on your first. That's like a golden rule. I thought we're talking about, real life NFL.
No, this is your fantasy team.
Oh, well, then let's edit this, because that shouldn't be that long of a thought process.
No, that's good.
Okay.
So no Brady.
No, you never take a quarterback your first round pick.
I did.
Did you lose?
No, I won. It was the year I won. Dante Culpepper.
Oh, that was like forever ago. That was like
40
that was like back
touchdowns.
When you had to take a quarterback your first
round. Well, not really. I mean, it was frowned upon, and I didn't have time to prepare for the draft because I was like an auxiliary.
Yeah.
Like basically I was there and somebody didn't show up.
Yeah.
Like, oh, you're picking number four overall.
I haven't taken a quarterback first round in a while. I think at one point I can't remember. It was like
I took Andrew Luck too once, and that screwed me. That was the year he got hurt.
Yeah, no, that was a bad pick. Yeah, it's been a while since I took a quarterback first round.
I usually don't either. I usually wait. But so Gronk fifth round. That's the answer. That's the answer.
Gronk.
Congratulations. He just got picked by Monique in the fifth round.
Gronk, vote Monique. Hopefully it happens.
Yeah. Yeah, you can vote. You can vote here in Tampa now.
Yes, you can. Tom Brady, vote Monique Scott as well.
Yeah, there you go.
I'll still pick you just a little bit later on.
Sorry. They'll pick you in the sixth round after she gets locks up Gronk in the fifth. Okay. So it says you like outdoor sports and activities.
I do. I'm a huge outdoor enthusiast and an adrenaline junkie.
Cool.
Fun fact. I have been skydiving and bungee jumping. So,
sweet.
Yeah, lots of, I've jumped off out of a perfectly good plane.
Yeah.
So I do like my fair share of adrenaline. I do like outdoor sports. I like tennis. I like running. I used to run a lot before I've torn both of my meniscuses and both knees. So not
all
running so much. Yeah. Biking, let's see what else. Kayaking, I love going to the beach. Kite surfing.
Oh.
Yeah, I'm not very good at it. I get dragged by the kite.
Wait till you hear this. Okay. So would you rather, I think I'm gonna know the answer, just based on something you said earlier.
Okay.
Now mind you, I wrote these, you know.
Before we had a conversation, I got to know you. Sure.
So now I think I probably know, but maybe I'm wrong. Would you rather windsurf off the coast of Australia in them shark-infested waters or downhill ski in the Swiss Alps?
Windsurf.
Windsurf.
Yeah.
With all the sharks.
Yeah, I mean, the chances of you, like, getting bitten by a shark, I mean,
well, I think the chances depend on where you are. Like, if you're in New Smyrna Beach, it's, like, almost 100%.
Yeah, I'll take that chance. That's
Australia.
Fine. Australia. I'll do it. I don't really like the cold. That's why I left D.C.
I kind of figured. That's what I thought from talking to you earlier about the
Would much
the whole
rather
DC.
Be
I was
at
like,
the beach.
Man, I put downhill ski on there.
Nope. No skiing.
Did you know that there's going to be a downhill ski place in Miami?
No. That's weird.
An indoor. They're supposed to build the largest mall in the world. And it's supposed to have an indoor downhill ski.
Interesting. Nope, didn't know that. That's interesting.
You learn something every time you talk to me.
I've learned a lot.
Anyway, Monique, thank you so much for being here. Is there any way, how can they get a hold of you if they need to? Where can they go? Do you have any websites?
Yeah, contact information. Here we go. So website is scottforjudge.com.
Scott Ford, not the four, not
the number
four?
Four.
Okay,
yeah.
Just like this.
Yeah.
Scott
for Judge.
Four,
judge.com. Let's see. Email address is Monique@scottforjudge.com. And my phone number is 813-758-4834. And just remember to get out there and vote. The election is August 18th. So I know many of you are thinking about November, but if you want to really make your vote count, you got to get out there August 18th.
August 18th, vote so you can vote again later.
Yeah, you'll have to actually
you have to vote twice. Two for one.
It's basically a runoff election type of thing. So I have to get past August in order to get on the ballot again in November. So lots of fun. Yeah.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Did you sell them your socials?
Oh, sorry. Yeah, social media is on all platforms. Facebook, which is Monique Scott for Judge. Instagram is Monique Scott for County Court Judge, kind of a longer one. And then Twitter is Scott for Judge.
Cool.
Yeah.
Very awesome. So again, thank you. This beer is about to go down, and this will be a wrap.
Cheers onto high quality H2O.
Yeah. Gotta have that.
Yeah.
That's good beer. By the way, 81 Bay Brewing, come check it out. It's pretty neat. Got some good beer and some good vibes, and the marketplace is pretty dope.
Great menu.